With no further ado, Russ Baker. Thank you, Russ.
It is great to be here. I was going to talk about research challenges. The first one is when the guy before you says it's lunchtime and it's not. So this, you know, I'm only half joking because as a relative newcomer to this community, I've only been involved with Kennedy stuff for about a decade. I know that's like yesterday to most of you. I am still grappling with some of the problems that I see with doing Kennedy research. And we're all imperfect, and that has a lot to do with it. But I did try. Oh, I don't know what that is. I didn't have a presentation, so I said, what's going on there? I did try to make a list of research challenges, some of the things that I've encountered. You may know I wrote a book called Family of Secrets. I hate to keep talking about it because it's been out for so many years now. People keep saying, when are you going to do another book? And I am working on another book, and it is just on Kennedy. The Family of Secrets has five chapters on the Kennedy assassination that all came from the question of why could George H.W. Bush not recall where he was on November 22, 1963. I think the fact that that issue is not deemed important by many people in this community tells you a lot about our inability to ever move forward or to grasp the larger picture of what has happened to this country. And I also think, and by the way, I want to congratulate all of you because these presentations are fabulous. The information about the paper bags, the information about the library card, the information about the photos and so forth, this is all fabulous work, but it goes to the point that there's so much out there that is not resolved 50 years later. We're still focusing on very, very microscopic things and trying to establish what those things mean. And so I started making a list of all of the challenges, all of the research challenges that we face, and I realized it was like trying to write an encyclopedia or perhaps a medical diagnosis of madness. And speaking of madness, what I'm trying to do with the book that I'm working on is to see if everything, not everything, but much can be assessed and whether it is possible to, with an open mind, look at some of these factors and establish something that would might not be in dispute, that almost any reasonable-minded person would look at it and say, yes, that's in fact what that is, and then take those things and see what you've got and see if you could create a coherent story that you could tell to anybody that could be told succinctly, could be shown to people who don't know anything about this, aren't interested, or think that this is crazy, and say, well, here are all of these things that just seem to us to be real and credible. And of course, I realize that trying to write any sort of book on this subject that makes sense to most people and is kind of clear and not too hard to read on its face sounds absurd to most of us, especially with the granular stuff that we've got here that's so important and still so unresolved. But it does seem to me like worth doing. I have other things to do. I work full-time running a news organization. I founded called whowhatwhy.org, a nonprofit. Some of you may know of it. We're dedicated to trying to improve journalism. And trying to, you know, whether you agree with Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or anything, everybody seems to be unhappy with journalism, and we feel that journalism could be much, much better and more trusted by people across the country of all backgrounds. And so that's my day job, so to speak, and I do the Kennedy stuff on the side. There are many issues. Why does this matter? What does it mean? What any of the pieces of it mean? Who did what? What evidence is what, and so forth? Awful lot. And so, essentially, you might say I've been studying all the things that have prevented forward movement, and that's what I'm going to try to talk about today. Certainly, the things that prevent forward movement include the obstruction and the cover-up by the establishment. But there are many, many more impediments, and I will get to those impediments, but I want to start with just the give you a sense of some of the problems. How many of you have been inside the National Archives of Maryland? Okay. I don't consider myself an expert. Malcolm usually comes to these things. He's not here. Malcolm Blunt probably is the expert. And I know some of you here are probably pretty good experts. So what I say may be wrong, but I've been in there a number of times. And my sense was that the National Archives don't really work. That when you go in there, it's confusing. I remember asking for guidance, speaking to librarians, in fact, reference librarians who are specifically assigned to the Kennedy Collection, and quickly discovering how little they knew, which mortified me. And then I would ask them, well, how do I look this thing up, and what does this thing mean? And they didn't know. And they referred me, and again, maybe I'm out of date, it's been a couple of years since I've been there, they have binders, and then they have computers, and with some of the stuff that's in the binders isn't in the computers, and some of the things that are in the computers aren't in the binders, and they told me you sort of have to look at both, and well, how do you do that? And of course, you're dealing with this vast number of documents. So the problem with the National Archives alone is just almost insurmountable. And I remember even talking to Malcolm about it and asking him, and he very candidly would say he didn't know about a lot of these things. And so just to give you a sense, and I'm going to try not to totally depress you here, but we are dealing with some very, very serious structural and systemic issues in trying to move forward. And as a journalist, and I want to distinguish about that, because we've also gotten to the point in this country where nobody seems to know what a journalist is. It seems to mean anybody who has the ability to type something and put it up on the web now as a journalist. But actually, journalism, just like being a doctor or a lawyer or anything, is a field. It's a craft, and there are certain things you're supposed to do. And one of the things you're supposed to do is you're supposed to not have a dog in the fight. You're not supposed to want some outcome. You're supposed to want to know what happened. That's really important. And so, as I have gone about my research, I always was asking, what does anything actually mean? What does this mean? We just saw how terrible all these crazy things about the Dallas Police Department. What does that mean? What does that mean that all those people are wacky or daft or incompetent or stupid or, you know, whatever it is? What does that mean? What does that mean that they're all carrying around guns and messing with the evidence and just, you know, all this crazy stuff? What does it mean? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, and I think we have to figure that out. Some of you may think you know. What does it mean when we look at FBI reports and they routinely misspell the surnames of the witnesses and the suspects? What does that mean? I don't know. I have been asking for a decade now, what does that mean? Are these people doing that deliberately? Are they lazy? Are they stupid? Are they reckless? I don't know, because the answer is probably all of the above. And then what do you do with that? Because you can't even prove a conspiracy if they're just a bunch of dumb clucks. We may just be looking at the dysfunction of our entire society to some extent. And so that may also be why the Kennedy case seems so surreal. Because a lot of the stuff we're looking at isn't part of the Kennedy assassination plot at all. It's just a society where many institutions and processes and techniques are not functioning properly. A society where criminality and cover your behind and go along to get along and fear and cowardice and not willing to take risks and all these other things of following what you're told, that these are the things. And to do the Kennedy assassination research, you have to sort of strip all this stuff away to see what's left. And that's very hard. So the FBI misspellings. What about, you know, to be fair, I mean, and I love you all dearly, but I mean, a lot of the books we put out are full of errors. You know, I've talked to some of my best friends in here, well, I won't say their names, but it makes me crazy. You know, they got three different spellings of somebody's surname on one page. And so I cannot say that the FBI is up to no good with misspelling if we're also doing the same thing. Trying to figure out agendas of everybody, right? Because you're looking at me and you're going, I wonder what that guy's agenda is. You know, they always say, oh, he's just trying to make money. He's writing books, you know, which to me is a kind of funny thing to say, because you go out in the street and there's a construction worker and you say, ah, he's just trying to make money by doing construction work. You know, why, if you are a professional author, why would you not need to get paid to write a book? I mean, so when you hear that, when you hear critics, people who are lone nutters and they try to use that, you should go right back at them and ask what that's supposed to mean. And are they going to say that about the police officer and the expert witness too? So what do these things mean? What are the agendas? Is a file real? Is a file real, or is it cover? I think Jim was Jim DeGino, I think you were talking about that yesterday. I'm sorry, I can't remember who was talking about this, but when you look at the files and you don't know if their file is a real file or if the file was put in there for some other reason, right? Because somebody was saying, you know, they have to have real files, right? You can't run something without some real files, but they seem to have an awful lot of fake files. One of my favorites, you may remember this if you read Family of Secrets, I have a whole chapter on George de Morenschild. George de Morenschild was leaving the country after seemingly handling Lee Harvey Oswald. He suddenly was exiting stage right and going to Haiti, which I think is very significant. I think they had to get him out of the picture, and I believe it was because he was a lifelong friend of George H.W. Bush, and I think they said, this guy cannot be around when this thing happens. And he left the country. But when he left the country, we now know that he stopped in New York and in Washington, and among other things, he had a meeting at, I believe it was the Knickerbocker Club in New York with some CIA people, and they wrote up a report. And the report says that they met with this de Morenschild and so forth, and they said that he had made some claims to them why he was going to Haiti, and he had some information for them. I believe that that whole report was deliberately placed in the files to provide a cover for why they were really meeting with this man. Or, in case anybody discovered that he had ties to the CIA, they could say, yeah, we met with this guy because he had some wacky idea to go into Haiti and do something with twine, sisal, and then he had some other plot, and maybe he was talking about that he wanted to overthrow Duvalier. So, you know, this whole thing gets very, very involved. And even that, we don't know whether the actual documents we have are of any value, except they established that they did, in fact, meet with him. And then, you know, there's a whole issue about what happens when we make mistakes. And, you know, I've made mistakes. I think we all make mistakes. We as time passes, we say, wait a minute, maybe this means something else. You know, I put something in my book about that LBJ talking to Richard Russell and explaining how he got Earl Warren to agree to be on the commission. And in my original hardcover, you can look at the difference in the hardcover and the paperback, I said that I wondered, or at least I sort of said wondered the way it was phrased, whether there was something that they knew about Earl Warren that they were using against him. And since then, something came out which seemed to suggest that was not what it was, and so in the paperback, I changed it, and now I'm starting to think maybe I was right in the first place, because the whole story of Earl Warren breaking down and crying, is the expression he used when they told him about a little incident down in Mexico, I mean, I could understand him being alarmed. I don't know why he would break down and cry. It sounds strange to me. So sometimes we find that you know when you go out and you buy a book, right? Their books are different editions, hardcover, paperback. Anthony Summers changes the name of his book, a new edition and so on. And people say, oh, you got to get the original. That's where all the good stuff is, right? And then, but you get the original and then you don't get the all the corrections that came in the later editions or the new analysis. So this is yet another problem I struggle with, and probably like most of you, I've got a library now with hundreds and hundreds of Kennedy books, and I'm always struggling with which you know, should be looking on Kindle or the hardcover or the paperback or the revised. I don't know. I don't know. And then you've got just so many things that are all over the place, like the statements of people who were considered for use by the CIA. Do you know what I'm talking about? Considered for use, not used. Who were those? George de Morenschild. I think, wasn't Clay Shaw, I think? Isn't there a file and it says that they had some interaction with him, but they never really used him?
Well, Russ, you know, that ended up being an exposed lie, don't you?
Sorry, what did?
Because the CIA Historical Review in 1994, it's in there black and white, we use Shaw as a very highly placed CIA asset for a number of years. Okay, so that first story you're talking about, that ended up being discredited by the agency itself.
I do know that he was a CIA asset, and I do know that there are records that show that, but my point is, you still got records that say the opposite. So depending on what comes out and what you see, you've got these problems. Then you got Priscilla Johnson McMillan, right? I mean, I have to say, for a woman who was rejected, she was sure there at all the right places, wasn't she? Amazing. How about the Payne family? When is a communist not a communist? I've spent a lot of time on the Payne family. I had the great pleasure of meeting Ruth Payne and spending an hour or so with her in her home. And she's I'm sure she's just a nice old lady, but I'm going to have her play an agent in my movie because she really pulls it off pretty well. But you know, this family and you know, all of this, somebody mentioned that the other day, you know, all this communist stuff around them, leftist, communist, whatever, which seems to be true, and yet they also seem to have been very much part of the national security structure. So then you have to get into that nuance. Well, yeah, because the left, you know, Cord Meyer, blah, 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 they were leftist, liberal, socialist or something, but they were worried about the Soviets, and they in those days it was patriotic to join up and do the right thing. So that's very complicated to figure out who these people are. And then you've got signs that the bad guys, like the Warren Commission staff, sometimes did the right thing. Doesn't that blow your mind? Suddenly, out of the blue, you see Beelen or one of these people doing the right thing, asking a real question, and you go, wow, what's that about? They seem indignant, righteous. I don't know. Misspellings, as I said, imprecision, self-interest permeates everything and everywhere. Bias in favor of previous things that we've all said or done or written. And discomfiture with new things coming along that may lessen or question that. These are hard things for any of us as human beings to deal with. Poor questioning. This is something that I've been trying to address as I go through and look at all of your work and trying to assess it and so forth, is sometimes, and I just want to be frank about this, I'll look at some questioning somebody did of somebody and I'll say, my gosh, you know, it's kind of like a damaged evidence scene. You know, they didn't ask the right questions. They were angry. They were opinionated. They were steering. They weren't listening to what the interviewee was saying. They weren't paying attention. They weren't following up. And, of course, we see this with the Warren Commission, where we assume that was deliberate. But we also see it in the research community. And it becomes very hard, because I know that when I call people, and I've been doing this most of my adult life, I'm very, very careful when I meet with people, and I drive them crazy. Is Gary here? Gary Shaw? Yeah, Gary. Yeah, I've been driving Gary crazy, you know, sitting at his house, and he sees what I do. I'll stay up all night going through some really obscure thing, just trying to figure out who the friend of a friend of somebody was. But you have to do that, because you're trying to get a good fix on these people. And you got to go outside the person to these concentric circles and then work your way back. It's a huge amount of work. It's very, very difficult. And then, so, you know, as I said, misconstruing answers, alienating sources. A lot of people tell me they won't talk to me because so many people called them and accused them of all kinds of nefarious things. And I say, well, I'm not going to accuse you. And if you look me up, I'm careful and I'm fair. And they say, oh, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to take a chance. And all those doors are closed to anybody who's come on this scene at all in any recent years. How about doubling? Anybody know that concept, doubling with agents? I don't know. I never seen the handbook on this, but they've got two of everybody. They got two Desmond Fitzgeralds. There were two George Bushes. Remember that? George Bush of the CIA, and they trotted this other guy out, and some people say that was him, young fellow who was hired by the CIA right before the assassination and let go right after. I don't think that's a coincidence. And then the CIA, which never discusses their own people, suddenly comes forward and says, oh, it's some other guy. Here he is. We can't find him. Yeah. Unusual. Jack Creighton. Remember Jack Creighton, the military intelligence reserve guy who was very closely tied into the Dallas Police Department intelligence people and had that weird underground bunker under Fair Park. This has never been investigated very much. I rarely hear people talk about it. I find it interesting. It was an underground communications bunker operating on November 22, 1963. I'd like to know more about that. Jack Creighton, an interesting fellow. He was running for the U.S. For governor when George H.W. Bush was running for U.S. senator. They were on the ticket, effectively, and they were campaigning in 1963. And so he and George Bush knew himself very, very well. And then I got all excited because I found George Bush in one of his memoirs talking about his good friend Jack Creighton. Except for guess what? It's another Jack Creighton, also from Texas. So I think, it sounds kind of crazy, but I think he found another Jack Creighton and he thought, I got a problem just like I did with DeMornshield. I'll just befriend the other Jack Creighton. And when people say, oh, you know Jack Creighton, you'll say, oh, you're getting it mixed up. So it's called, I call it doubling. I have no proof that it's an official policy, but I found a guy in the CIA, lived in a certain place, had done certain things, had a, I thought, not that common a name. And everything worked, and I was like, wow. And then suddenly his wife's name was different. So I said, have you been married before? And he said, nope. I said, your wife's name is not, you know, Jennifer? He said, nope. And I was like, oh, my gosh, there's two guys in the CIA who are almost identical, never heard of each other, same name, everything else, different wife. So it's hard to do this work. How about two Richard Sprague's, right? You ever get over that one? The Richard Sprague, the researcher, and the Richard Sprague with the committee. So this goes on. And do you know there are two Russ Bakers, by the way? I actually wrote a piece for the New York Times. I don't know if anybody ever saw it. It was on the op-ed page. It was called I'm the Other Guy. How many Oswalds? Okay, that I don't know. I've got a friend. I don't know if he's here or not, but he grew up in Dallas, and he... dated the granddaughter of D. Harold Byrd, where Oswald worked. His teacher was Ruth Payne. I'm not making this up. And he once was trying to put me on the phone with Pierre Fink, who he knew, who was at the doctor at the autopsy in Bethesda. This guy is not a conspirator. He just knows a bunch of people. So that's life. Even Gary Shaw used to go to Jack Ruby's club, didn't you, Gary? All right, so... You know, look at him suspiciously. Okay, so you got all this stuff. How about all the supernatural stuff? Talk about obstacles, the seances, you know, all this stuff with Mary Bancroft and Dulles hung out with a crowd that were interested in all this sort of supernatural stuff, convening with spirits. Some people think that the Kennedy assassination had something to do with suppressing UFO research. There were these MK Ultra mind control experiments. Try to get your hands around that stuff and see how many people are still going to follow you. How about the defectors? Gary Mack, Posner, Ed Epstein, Tink Thompson seems to have moved around a little bit in terms of what he says. He did that video you may have seen on the New York Times making fun of Umbrella Man and saying that was nothing. That was just a man who was signaling his dislike for Joe Kennedy and appeasement by pumping an umbrella at the exact second when the shots are firing into the gut. This was on the New York Times. This was our beloved 6 seconds of Dallas Tink Thompson. So complicated figuring all this stuff out and how people move around and change. Tons of unlikely things. Was it Larry Hancock on the con man with the library card? You know, just there's a lot of stuff that's just weird. And we don't think that con men go to the library, but maybe they do. I don't know. Disreputable people. It's this whole story is full of disreputable people, but you know, maybe most people are disreputable. I don't know. Maybe the kind of people who are available to get involved in being guns for hire are not upstanding citizens, you know? And maybe if you want to use them as a witness, you can't, because people say, well, he's not an upstanding citizen. When he says he shot the president, you can't believe him. It's a problem. Egos, grudges, books, organizations, lone nutters, the sixth-floor museum. How about that? Talk about an obstacle. Although I do like this guy, the new guy. He I thought was actually trying to be fair, Mr. Fagan. Trolls, discrediting the theories. How about all the theories about the real reason, right? Does everybody in this room agree what the real reason for this was? And then some people think that the initial cover-up was designed to create a lot of red herrings, and other people would say no, they actually accidentally occurred. There were lots of anomalies because things go wrong, and people are not all that smart, and they don't plan that well, and probably the truth is some combination of that. How about the difficulty of discerning patterns that might mean something, and those that probably don't mean anything? And then you've got all the accidents, the deaths, right? The list of the deaths. And as much as we see all those suspicious deaths, the problem is probably some of them were not suspicious deaths, but one thing they did do, guess what that list did do? It scared people. It scared people, made it harder to do research, even though I think it was a good intent putting those lists out. Played right into their hands, whoever they are. How about too much proof? Can you believe it? We have too much proof. That's what you guys are doing. You guys are piling proof on proof on proof, and there's a problem, which is that we're interested in this, but most people aren't. And that's a real problem. That's kind of where this talk is going, is about the challenge of reaching other people. Now, I know we like to do this. Let's admit it. We're all addicted, aren't we? This is fun. It's a horrible topic. It's an important topic. I don't want to say we don't do it for the right reasons. I think we do. And I think the talks like Jim's about the foreign policy and so forth, these are the big issues. These are the things I tend to gravitate toward and care about mostly. But, yes. It's the ultimate murder mystery, he says. Correct, absolutely. And so it has that allure, and we're hooked on it. But there's a gap between us and the general public who's like, listen, I'm trying to survive, you know? I'm trying to get my mind off of work and family problems and things. I'm watching stupid cat tricks, okay? So if you're going to compete with that, you better be brief. There appears to be a lot of fraud in the evidence. I was alluding to that a little bit with the memos and covering memos and so on. But, you know, things have been substituted, altered, falsified, destroyed, suppressed. So you have to sort through an awful lot to find out what is the most plausible, accurate evidence. Witnesses get discredited all the time. And don't we do that? We go out, we'll go out to lunch now. We'll argue about, oh, that person has no credibility. Is Beverly here? Beverly's not here. Okay. Some people believe Beverly, some people don't believe Beverly. I mean, this is just true in general, and it's a challenge. We tend to accept labels that other people give us. Oh, you can't believe that person. That guy's trying to sell books. Oh, okay, not listening to him, not reading his book. LA Times, review of my book. The guy, I think, never read the book, and he just made it sound like I didn't believe that we'd landed on the moon, and he threw that all together, and then he said, we'd all do ourselves a favor and not read this book. And I was thinking, how many people read a book review and actually literally read that line, we'd all do ourselves a favor and not read this book, and say, hey, honey, I'm not going to read this book. Don't know. Let's see. I'm going to save some time for questions. Somebody sent me a note I want to share with you, a friend of mine, who said, here are some of the usual reasons given to explain why witnesses make particular claims. This is people who are discrediting witnesses. There's nothing wrong with what's on this list. The problem is what's not on the list. Here's the list. Why somebody made a claim. They were fooled by some acoustic phenomenon or visual illusion. You've heard that, right? For some psychological reason, they only thought they saw it. They didn't really see or hear it. They're just repeating what others said. Or they are exaggerating or even lying in order to get attention, or if a book is involved, money. What's missing from this list? They said they saw it because they actually saw it. Unlikely as it may seem, that is sometimes the reason. Unless the witness is clearly lying or delusional, they should never be dismissed, or even if their claims are at the bottom of your own list of possibles. And this is really, I think, profound. And one of the things I'm trying to do, and this is very, very hard, is do you know that if you got a witness, if you're in law enforcement, you particularly understand this, if you have a witness and you find that they told a lie ever, you can't disqualify them as a witness. In fact, we're all told to lie all the time. Somebody said to me, well, Russ, I mean, I like you, but you're a polarizing figure. You know what that means? I don't lie enough. Need to lie more. You look good in that outfit. Hey, you lost weight. We lie all the time. We lie all the time, right? Protect your family's honor. How much trouble are you going to get in with your spouse if you don't lie to protect the family's honor? So lying is normal, and lying cannot disqualify a source. The problem is you have to get to know that source so well you can actually figure out what is lies and what's truth, and then get documentation. In journalism, we say you need multiple sources. And then there's the whole thing about fake news, right? You heard that? Facebook and Twitter and everything are under pressure because there are all this fake news out there. Well, as we all know, it's all fake, isn't it? In some sense. I mean, is CNN the gospel? I mean, you know, officials said, you know, sources in the Pentagon privately told us, you know, yeah, right. Okay. So we have seen an increase in false stories regarding the Kennedy assassination. Have you noticed that? There's just stories out all the time popping up everywhere, and then you're like, oh gosh, is that deliberate? I mean, probably. Some of it, I would think, makes sense. Being deliberately planted by disinformation agents. It's always a mystery to me after 50 years who, you know, I don't know, do you think there are people here who are disinformation agents? You are a disinformation? Oh, you agree. Okay. Okay. Oh, there you go. Well, couldn't be up to anything then. Yeah. So no, but this is a problem, right? Because here we are half a century later. As far as I know, that wasn't Alan Dulles disguised as a bag lady. So those people are all gone. And who's doing this, right? I mean, I don't know if anybody has the answer. And I ask former CIA people, how does this all work? And they don't know. So the issue is, how is this stuff being perpetuated, by whom? Who are the people who read this stuff? You know, did you see the woman at the National Archives who was appointed to be in charge of all this? She's the CIA person who was in charge of the 9/11 intelligence. They put her in charge of vetting all of this stuff. You know, I mean, she wasn't involved in the Kennedy assassination. She's probably not even a bad person, but I think she understands what her job requires. She can read stuff and go, ooh, I think we'll just put that back in the envelope. So we deal with all these things. All right, so let me start wrapping up here. We do owe a great debt. I owe a great debt to all of you, and I want you to know that I don't think I'm better than you. I think most of you, many of you, know more than I do about many things. And I want to ask you questions, and I want to read your books, and I want to read them again, and then I want to ask you more questions, and so on. There is a tremendous debt owed to this amazing bunch of people who do this stuff selflessly their whole lives. I mean, this is phenomenal, and I hope to get into that in my book, is this phenomenon, which I think is so important. This may be the greatest revelation out of the whole thing, if nothing else, is just the fundamental goodness, decency, and tenacity of a segment of the American and, let's say, Canadian and, let's say, English and Australian and whatever other publics. Yeah. So, but anyone researching this, as I said, or more importantly, anyone wishing to know what can be established as true faces daunting odds, there are a lot of mistakes, but still the work is important. Or put another way, the work is important, but there are a lot of mistakes. And a lot of obstacles that must be realistically addressed. There are too many documents. There are too many. And yet, not enough of the right ones. There are too many books we can't read. I know, Deborah, are you here? She got mad at me saying there were too many books because she's got some new books coming out. But there are too many books. We don't have time to read them. I know probably most of you haven't read mine. I have tried to read as many of yours as I can, but the way I see it, I think there's a Kennedy book coming out about every day. Am I wrong about that? Maybe it's every week. Maybe it's every week. But there's more than 50 a year, aren't there? So it's probably every few days. We can't read them. We don't know what's in each other's books. How many of you, here's a question, how many of you think that the Texas School Book Depository was a building? Raise your hand. You're raising your hands timidly. Okay. How many of you don't think it was a building? Okay. Was it a flying saucer?
It was a business inside that building.
The Texas School Book Depository was a company that was a tenant in a building. And this is very important. And I have in Family of Secrets, I have a whole section. I spent a year on the Texas School Book Depository because I'm not saying that's not been written anywhere. I don't remember seeing it. And I kept saying, remember Oswald was hired, he worked in the Texas School Book Depository, remember? And the name you kept hearing was Roy Truly, the superintendent. I was like, what's a superintendent? And what's a superintendent of a school book depository? What's a school book depository? I don't know. Are books so valuable you got to put them in a depository? So I didn't know. Is it a suppository? I don't know. So I started looking at all this stuff, trying to figure it out. I didn't know. And I started digging into this, and I was like, who's Roy Truly? Well, guess what? Roy Truly, he's not the superintendent of the building, and he doesn't run the school book depository company either. That's another guy. You ever hear anything about the other guy? No. But I thought it was interesting that the day after his employee, Lee Harvey Oswald, shot Kennedy, he put on a lavish wedding for his daughter. He did not cancel the wedding, and everybody was just as happy as could be. I got a bunch of stuff in there on that. But I mean, I find that very interesting. Too many things, too many books to read. We haven't been able to collate all of them. Too many theories, too many angles, too many suspects, too many feuds, right? Feuds? How many of us don't speak to each other or snarl? Okay. Too many feuds, too many egos, too many mistakes, too much uninformed personnel working in these archives and things, too many confusing procedures, a small core of enthusiasts, a huge number of simultaneous projects and books, being in a hurry. Of course, we are all in a hurry. Why are we in a hurry? Because we aren't 21 anymore, except for maybe one person in here. But we aren't 21 anymore. It seems time seems shorter and shorter. And every time I ask everybody for anything, you always say, I can't do it. I got to get another book out. You know, it's like a race against time. And so we opt for quantity over quality. One book after another, no time to spell right, no time to consult others to make sure we got it right. These are not strengths, they're not virtues. The right way to do it. Rules of the road for a journalist. No preferred outcome. No preferred outcome. If it happens that Lee Harvey Oswald did do it after all, that's the way it goes. No protection of ourselves when new facts are discovered. No protection of relationships or pet theories. A willingness to go wherever the material takes you. The determination to get it right. Use multiple sources, obviously documents. Provide historical and other context. Don't feel that you have to write a book. You can write a book. I write books. I can't tell people not to write books, but not everybody should feel that they have to write a book. And Bill Simpich, is Bill here? Bill mentioned that he is not going to be writing any more books. He does terrific research. I mean, I'd love to work with him. And this gets down to an issue that Gary brought up the other day. He said, you know, I really wish there was a clearinghouse, that there was some central place where all of this stuff could be coming and be assessed and vetted and matted and mapped and plotted out. I thought that needed to be done. I am trying to do it. It's hard. I have a certain organizational experience and so forth, and some people who help me, and I'm sort of trying to do it. It's of course impossible, too mammoth, and everything you start trying to verify, you go down that path, and it takes too much time. But somehow we have to think that way. Whether it's me or it's anybody here, we do need to try to cooperate and bring those things. Because I come to these conferences, I don't know how many years. Most of the stuff I hear, probably half of it, I never heard that before. I never heard that version before, exactly the thing. And so you're going, oh, I got to get the transcript, and I got to go through it. And then do we ever have time to do that? There's too much stuff here that we all know individually, but we don't know collectively. Talk to others and discuss your findings. Be ready to rethink everything. Press the institutions, National Archives, all of them, press the institutions. At who, what, why, we're going to be pressing them on those documents. And Jimmy Falls, Jimmy's back there in the room. Raise your hands, I can see you. Talk to Jimmy if you want to help. We want to do more. You probably know that Who, What, Why was the first website to mention all these documents. That was discovered that you know the whatever you call them the headers and all this stuff which enabled some of these presentations yesterday where we're looking at you know the cryptonyms and all that kind of stuff and so we're doing our part. We've been writing a lot working with people like Jim Lassard and so on who are trying to get the records to press the government and make this an issue for the public. Because if this becomes an issue for the public, it's going to be like Oliver Stone all over again, and they're going to feel compelled to do something. Although overwhelmed by the volume, do not ignore names or details. One guy, Romney, are you here? Romney Stubbs. Okay, he found some amazing stuff in an archive in New Orleans. He was sure that he would just do it next time he came back there. The stuff from somebody's address book and phone numbers and so on that was quite significant. When he came back, it was gone. Gary was just telling me about something where he had taken some notes from somebody, but he didn't take too many notes because somebody was recording it. Well, he never heard the recording again. So don't take any chances. Take every note and do it right away. Just wrapping up here. Or as they say, work with others, focus on the ultimate goal, and keep an open mind, listen to others. None of us have figured it out, but together we might have a shot. Thank you very much. Question from the gentleman in the back.
No credible evidence. So as soon as you hear that, you know there's a concerted effort on the part of whoever they are, the other opinions. So how do you, this is a question for you, how do you tell somebody, because I deal with people, in one or two sentences to get them interested, not say on hold or whatever, how do you get them interested to even look at this stuff?
Well, here's what I told Vince Bugliosi when I met him at a party. I said, he said, oh, yeah, I heard I'm supposed to read your book. And he said, but, you know, it's all settled and so on. And I said, hey, Vince, what about boom, 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 boom? And he said, well, I don't know about any of that stuff. And I said, exactly. I said, you know almost nothing about this. And look, you wrote, what, a 2,000-page book?
What are those three things that you say, though, to somebody? What are three things to get
you? You know, I mean, somebody said there was a rumor about the gun being a different gun, right? I mean, is that a rumor? I mean, I thought those sheriff's deputies stated that they saw it and that it was a Mauser. Now, either they stated it or they didn't. And so the way I do my book is I go and I say, did they state it? And where? Under oath? In a document? Is anybody, have they ever been quoted and did they ever say, no, I didn't say that? And so forth. That's how you do it. It's just it's a lot of detail work. Man, way in the back. Yeah, you. Yeah.
Does the president have power just by the stroke of his pen to order the release of some documents and unredact them? Yes. And this, I think I find it fascinating because Donald Trump doesn't
get on with the Bushes. So might we have hope that, you know, some of this stuff, you know, Donald Trump, you know, he could be sort of unpredictable, and do we have any hope that some of these things now might find release.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little window which probably already closed before he ever took the oath of office. Just watch the Bill Hicks documentary about what they do when they put new president. They put him in a room right the first day, and they show the movie back and to the left, back and to the left, back, and they say, "Any questions, Mr. President?" So you know, I think this. You know, Roger Stone has ridden this particular issue quite a bit, and Roger talks to Donald, and I sometimes talk to Roger, and you know, Donald, at least a lot of his voters are really into this stuff. Now, their reasons for being into it are largely because they don't want government, they don't want to pay any taxes, and so anything that makes the government look bad, they like. But it's a start. And you can form an unusual coalition, ironically, between sort of the left and the right in Congress, and there might be a moment that Trump would see this as to his advantage.
I just want to thank you so much. Are there any other questions for us? Okay. I really, now that I've heard your complete presentation and not the abbreviated one that you had to give the other day, I do want to congratulate you for bringing up some excellent points. I've been sitting back there, as a researcher and also a publisher, considering everything that you've said, and I agree with most of it because I quit reading a lot of the books years ago. I just can't read them all. Even if I know the person, I may not read their book. And I admitted yesterday to Stephen Fagan that I bought his book and he signed it, and we've been friends for 12 years, and I didn't read it. And in there was that chapter about Mr. Briggs, who was a CIA very high up, and he was brought in to help design the exhibit for the Sixth Floor Museum. And that's in his book. It's been in his book for years, and no one read it. And, you know, if you go back and read and even get the oral histories of him and the other two people who worked on the Sixth Floor Museum's exhibit, the architects were scared to death of him. They had no choice but to work with him. He was brought in, okay? It's fascinating, but no one read it.
Yeah.
So I think we need to talk to each other. We need to do more reviews. Do not think you have to have the perfect review or a long review. You can post, "I just read this book and this is what I saw in it that I agree or disagree or want people to know about," in one paragraph on your own Facebook page, and pass it around. Send it to me. You know, because we don't know, and we can't all read all books, and he's right, and you're right. Now, lastly, I want to address the typos. Your first printing always has typos. I don't care how many people review it, how many programs you run it through. Do you know that we had to call back a book that we had already ordered? It was printed and at my house, and we noticed that the name on the back was spelled wrong. Do you know how many people looked at that book and that cover before it was sent to the printer? At least 200 people, easy. Family, friends, researchers, everything. The name was misspelled. Our publicist found it after they were delivered to her office.
Yeah.
Okay? It happens. The first printing, it's going to have a typo in it.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It's unavoidable.
Yeah. But then hopefully if you read the book and you tell me or you tell us, the authors or the publisher, "I found this on page such and such," we will be so happy for you to point it out, please, so we can fix it for the next printing. But I just wanted to say those some more. So I think everything you said was awesome. I'm so glad that you came and gave this talk.
Thanks, Deborah. And hey, how about Deborah and what the work she's done all these years? And her whole team and the people back there videotaping and the people at the tables out there. I mean, I don't think they get enough recognition, so we should all thank them. Thanks. I guess it's lunchtime.